Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It's been a week of dizzying developments for the U.S., Iraq, and the international community. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Capitol Hill, 2 days ago, the importance of timing.
Delaying a vote in Congress would send the wrong message, in my view, just as we are asking the international community to take a stand, and as we are cautioning the Iraqi regime to respond and consider its options.
The Iraqi regime, quick to respond earlier this week, an offer to accept inspectors without conditions. But yesterday, Foreign Minister Naji Sabri at the UN with a letter from President Saddam Hussein.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hereby declare before you that Iraq is totally clear of all nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons.
President Bush dismisses the letter as the same old song and dance we've heard for 11 years. The diplomatic and domestic push continued yesterday with Secretary of State Colin Powell before the House International Relations Committee with the text, the exact words of Bush's proposed congressional resolution.
The president should be authorized to use all means he determines appropriate, including military force, to enforce the United Nations Security Council resolutions Iraq is defying and to defend the United States and its interests against the threat Iraq poses and to restore international peace and security to the region.
Resolutions circulating in Washington and New York, votes, timing, similar songs and dances on both sides. It is confusing. So we have on the program today two journalists who know Congress and the UN inside out to help us make sense of it. And we'd like you to join us, Connection listeners. Is it starting to make sense? Or is it getting more complicated? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You can, of course, join us online at theconnection.org. And with me for the hour today, Linda Wertheimer, NPR's senior national correspondent. She spent this week anchoring our coverage of the congressional testimony. And Robin Wright, chief diplomatic correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Robin spent much of the past 2 weeks in New York sorting through events there. She joins us on the phone. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much.
Let's start with the latest. Earlier today, Bush is reported to have called Russian President Vladimir Putin. Later today, he's to meet Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov and Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov at the White House. Robin, you've been writing in your analysis pieces that watching this is key. The talks between Russia and the United States will help us understand what comes next.
Absolutely. Russia, of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, is the one that is most reluctant to pass a new resolution that would give the United States any kind of authority to act against Saddam Hussein if he does not comply with the UN weapons inspectors. The Russians basically believe that there's no need for a resolution now that Saddam Hussein has allowed the weapons inspectors to return after a four-year hiatus. The talks today in Washington will really be key to, first of all, not only whether there's a resolution, but if the U.S., as it believes, does get something through the U.N. in the next 10 days or so, whether it is just a simple call on Saddam Hussein to allow the weapons inspectors unfettered access to all equipment, or whether it actually has some teeth to it, whether it adds a clause that says if Saddam Hussein does not comply, the international community may retaliate. That's really the key, because the United States feels without that Saddam Hussein can do what he's done for the last 11 years, and that's stall.
Linda, give me the perspective from Washington, because as I try to make sense of what's happening in those two cities, I'm looking at the UN Security Council, the tension and the drama that Robin's describing there, and I'm listening to what's coming out of Washington, and what's coming out of Washington seems, in comparison, somewhat bloodless, almost as if the congressional hearings and the vote, whenever it takes place, the results are already known.
Well, I think that there is a strong whiff of going through the motions here. There is, I would imagine, somewhere between 60% and 70% agreement on the, say, for example, the House International Relations Committee about the main goals that the president is talking about. I would imagine that they would give the president something like the kind of authorization he wants. Mr. Powell said yesterday in the committee, he was asked what the United States would be doing differently in terms of trying to brief the Congress and persuade the people if Iraq had not responded with the you know, the apparent invitation to inspectors. Mm-hmm. And he said we would be doing nothing differently. They regard everything that Iraq has done to this date as a ploy, and that's a word they keep using, and they don't believe it. And Mr. Rumsfeld is quite jocular about it. "You've got to be kidding," is one of the quotes from his appearance before the House Armed Services. I was interested to hear Mr. Powell say yesterday that if the United Nations, if the Security Council were to decide that no new resolution is needed and that inspectors should just simply go back in, that the United States will move to prevent that.
Prevent that?
Yes, to prevent that, because they feel that the current inspection regime is too weak, that it would not achieve anything, and that it would be completely meaningless and delaying, and therefore the United States would prevent it.
Linda, the congressional leaders who are going through the White House and meeting with the president, do you have any sense that the message they're getting is in any way different from the public message that the administration's been putting out in the congressional hearings? I watched the Democratic leaders coming out and saying, no, we will stand behind the president. Are they hearing something that we're not?
Very good question. I have heard people who have been in briefings, I haven't talked to the leaders of the Congress, but I have talked to people who have been in some of the briefings at the Defense Department that are given to high-level advisors in and out of the government, former officials, that kind of thing. And they seem to find these briefings quite frightening. So it may be that the administration is prepared to say some things that they in private that they are not prepared to say in public. But, you know, the administration is always fairly cautious and conservative about briefing the Congress, because the Congress, like the press, you know, has a bad habit or a good habit, in my view, of telling everything they know. So I'm not sure. I don't know what the answer to that question is.
But the same thing's happening in New York, Robin, because we listened to Rumsfeld telling the congressional committees that, yes, in fact, there are countries willing to stand behind the United States, but we can't tell you who they are and they won't tell you who they are. And so do you get the sense that in the time that you spent watching Powell there, that there was one message behind closed doors and a different one being delivered publicly?
Not so far, but I do think that you're going to see just that happen today in Washington when the president and the secretary meet with the defense and foreign ministers of Russia. They're likely to get the same kind of briefing, I am told, with a lot of very specific intelligence data outlining what the United States thinks Iraq has in the way of weapons of mass destruction and what it has been able to do in the 4 years since the weapons inspectors have been able to check out all of its facilities.
And picking up on something that Linda was saying, what would it mean? How would it play at the United Nations if the U.S. actually stepped in and said, you know, forget the inspection, prevent it?
I think that's a bit of political blackmail, and I think that it's trying to squeeze reluctant members of the Security Council to go along with some kind of initial resolution. One of the games that's being played now is the issue of how many resolutions at the United Nations and the timing of them. The United States wants one sweeping resolution that outlines what Saddam Hussein has to do and what the consequences are if he doesn't. The French have proposed a two-resolution formula where you have one resolution that says Saddam Hussein must comply and he's been in material breach in the past, and a second one that says there may be consequences if he does not comply. What the Russians have suggested in the past, before Saddam Hussein came up with this offer to let the weapons inspectors back, was a formula that said, let's have that second resolution only after a material breach, which could effectively prolong the whole period and involve President Bush and his top foreign policy team in a major round of diplomacy that's much harder than the one they've gone through over the past week.
And Linda, can you shine a little bit of light for us on what Robin raised, the issue of timing, that sense from the secretaries that the vote must take place before congressional representatives go back for the campaign, that it must precede a UN Security Council vote, that there is this real rush on?
There is a full court press going on here in Washington. Cabinet members fanning out across the Capitol to speak to members of Congress and to speak to committees. This is part of a, you know, both a public and private effort to persuade. And it is not, you know, there are not a lot of people who are, I think, wildly opposed to what the administration is trying to do. So this is sort of a big selling point. But as Mr. Powell said, what they want is what he called a certain trumpet. They want a strong vote, and they want it soon, and they want it without much bickering about the kinds of what the text that the president, it's not much difference from the text the president has presented. And they want that because they hope to use it to essentially force the United Nations to face the fact that the United States is prepared to move. And, you know, it goes back to that word, which I mean, Robin can tell us what the UN, the folks at the UN would hear when the president talks about the relevance of the UN. But I think that, that they're trying to push on that issue by saying, we're ready to go, so move.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things in that resolution was the fact that Saddam Hussein's name is never mentioned. And the one reference to changing the regime in Baghdad is mentioned only in context of a congressional act passed in 1998, the Iraqi Liberation Act, that in which Congress said it was their sense that Iraq would be better off with another regime in Baghdad, so that the administration, rather than coming out and saying, we intend to go all the way to Baghdad and, you know, oust Saddam Hussein, is invoking a congressional act and trying to do it in a way that does not sound abrasive, aggressive, both to a domestic audience, but just as much to a United Nations audience, which will be watching very closely what Congress does and what the U.S. domestic resolution says.
But, Robin, you know, one of the things Mr. Powell said, and you know, Mr. Powell describes himself as a reluctant warrior. He says it's a label I embrace. He said, in answer to the question, if the United States goes into Iraq again, will the United States be there to win? This was a question from the delegate from American Samoa. And Mr. Powell answered one word, yes.
Yes,
which I thought sounded relatively bellicose for the reluctant warrior.
Defining win in what way? I mean,
well, I think that this whole notion of replacing depose, topple, and other kinds of words like that with regime change is an interesting use of language. But I think that that throughout this week, members of the cabinet, as they appear before the Congress, are talking about how if disarmament is the goal, that regime change is the preferred method. As Mr. Rumsfeld was very, very seriously arguing throughout his appearances on the Hill, that you cannot completely expect to disarm a nation that is well schooled in hiding by simply going around with inspectors, that the regime has to want to disarm and show you where the things are. That means not Saddam Hussein.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Disarmament, regime change, overthrowing Saddam Hussein. What's in the language? What's not? What's the hurry? And how much sense is it making to you as the pace continues the way it has? 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. And Connection listeners, your chance to cut through all the whereases and the be it resolved to make sense of what's been an extremely busy diplomatic and domestic political week in the push of the Bush administration to hold Iraq's feet to the fire and threaten them if they choose not to do that. And with us on the program to help me and you with your questions, Linda Wertheimer, Senior National Correspondent for National Public Radio, and Robin Wright, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Robin, perhaps you can just pick up the point that Linda was talking about prior to the break about The difference between disarm and overthrow, does that go back to what you were saying about the international desire to try and split the resolution between compliance and consequences?
Well, I think the international community is united in trying to get Saddam Hussein to disarm. Everyone is concerned. His neighbors, the Russians, the French, all the members of the permanent members of the Security Council are behind that. I think there is real concern, however, about this issue of ousting a regime, and there is concern even by the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, about violating the initial charter of the UN and pushing too far in taking on a sovereign state that has not acted aggressively against the United States in a specific way. But I think there is a feeling in Washington that when you get into weapons of mass destruction, that you can eliminate perhaps the arsenal, the current arsenal, but when you have the people and the facilities, and all you have to do is buy the equipment, or in the case of chemical and biological weapons, you know, the kind of what they call the medium to create it, that it's just around the corner, that he will try again. The weapons of mass destruction are a function of Saddam Hussein's personality and his ambitions regionally and perhaps even globally, and that disarming and sending in weapons inspectors is not enough. And I think this is where the real gap is between the United States and the rest of the world.
Linda Wertheimer, did you hear any evidence of that gap listening to the Secretary of State yesterday? There's been lots written and said about Colin Powell's discomfort with the way that the Bush administration is proceeding. You talk about him as a reluctant warrior, but he's been also a pretty good soldier this past week.
No question about it. I think there was, to some extent, Rumsfeld and Powell were doing a kind of good cop, bad cop routine. Rumsfeld came to the Hill to say that Saddam Hussein is dangerous beyond anything that we can talk about, and that there were all sorts of very serious reasons why nothing short of a regime change, to use their language, would be enough. Mr. Powell came to the Hill to say that all diplomatic routes should be attempted. Both of them talk about how no one rushes into war. The president has not made the decision yet. I mean, they're all leaving the door open a crack. But Mr. Powell, I think, in the role of good cop, is basically saying, we want to work with the UN. We want to work with our friends. But underlying what he said was this very strong impression, at least I had a very strong impression, that the threat must be backed, that the diplomacy must be backed up with a credible threat. And when he was asked, does this mean that we send American troops into combat and they lose their lives, he said, it is my job, our job, to see that none of those lives are wasted. But he's, you know, he says you attempt to avoid war, but sometimes war comes. So they're all on the same page. I think there's no question about that. Mr. Powell is, whatever his doubts may be or may have been, I think they're all together.
Well, I tend to think, though, that Powell has won this round in terms of U.S. policy and strategy in dealing with Saddam. He convinced, anyway, the administration to detour on the road to Baghdad via the United Nations. And he is now in the very difficult position of having to sell this strategy to the rest of the world.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. My comment is, since Rumsfeld has stated in the last 24 to 36 hours that the war on Hussein and al-Qaeda is won, there should be...
One as in O-N-E or W-O-N?
O-N-E.
Thank you.
There should be a furious resistance across the country to the administration's presentation since the testifying of the victim's family and the 12 incidents of planes being used as weapons, and Condoleezza Rice saying May the 15th, which has been publicized everywhere when she was quoted.
You're saying putting the two together, September 11, 2001, and Iraq, is something that you're starting to see the administration do more of, Michael?
Well, that's exactly what they're saying in order to say it is one war on terrorism. But that isn't my overall point. The point is that since September 11th, Cheney has lied that there were no signals of what was coming. Condoleezza Rice, the absolute outrageous statement, May the 15th, that we had no idea that planes could possibly be used.
Michael, I need you to get to your point.
The point is there should be a furious resistance to the whole presentation of the administration's war in Iraq because they've been proven flagrant liars
but
for
there's
the last
not,
12 months.
Michael, there is not resistance in Washington. Are you puzzled by that?
Yes, a bit. I mean, Kerry is making, you know, some light points. It's that incredible jingoistic popularity thing when they wage war, so there's a fear of going against them. But
Linda, can you be that simplistic about it?
Well, there is. If I could divide the question as a member of Congress would. There is a lot of concern on the Hill about the whether the case that there is a terror connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and the notion that Saddam Hussein might bestow weapons of mass destruction on people who would be willing to bring them into the United States. That is the case the administration is attempting to make, and there's a lot of concern on the Hill that they are not making it. However, on a different track, the Intelligence Committee of the House and Senate, the Joint Intelligence Committee, has started holding hearings to which the caller referred to examine what the president knew and when he knew it and what the previous president knew and when he knew it about what might happen in terms of terror attacks on the United States. And there is an effort which I think is going to go forward next week to create an independent commission to investigate this. There's the possibility, the talk I hear is that it may be attached to the Homeland Security legislation. There are members of Congress who are very concerned about failures of intelligence and feel that those failures of intelligence have not been properly examined or explained, and that the administration has refused to turn over some of the information about what exactly the president was told about the possibility of terror attacks in the United States in 2001. So the Congress is not unmindful of the concerns that the caller is raising. They have not done it yet, but they are beginning with the Intelligence Committee, and the possibility does exist of some kind of an investigation. But I think the caller is quite right in saying that, you know, as the United States prepares to confront Saddam Hussein, that does change the equation quite a bit.
1-800-423-8255. Michael, thanks for your call. To Newton, Massachusetts, Kathy's on the line. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hello. Well, back to the fundamental principles and what this resolution could mean. Isn't it, as a resolution to basically authorize congressional action before UN action, isn't it actually a seeking a permission to violate the UN Charter, where Article 51 makes it absolutely clear that unilateral force is justified only in the case of armed attack, self-defense against armed attack, not threat, but armed attack? And won't this, if they do it, simply strike down the legal prohibition against unilateral aggressive war that has been probably the most significant, valuable social accomplishment of the 20th century at the cost of some of the bloodiest wars in history? So who is envisioning what this could mean for the future?
Let me go to Robin Wright with that, because, Robin, it seems to me in the resolution that's coming from the White House that they're leaning very heavily on the self-defense part to justify the unilateral action.
Yes, it's which part of the UN Charter do you invoke? But I think the caller's question is reflected in a lot of the concern in the rest of the world about what precedent this does set. What if Russia wants down the road to, you know, deal with its own populations or something nearby, or more importantly, China dealing with Taiwan, that this sets a precedent that is very ominous for future conflicts, not always in a region, perhaps even, you know, in this globalizing world, a country as far away as the United States taking on Iraq. So it's not just in a neighborhood.
And can I add, just a path going back just 10 years, wasn't it this very prohibition that made possible the worldwide support for action against Iraq when it invaded Kuwait? And if there were no such standard in the world, if that were struck down, if we're regressing from it, you know, could that have happened? I'm not saying it should have happened, but could it have happened as it did? So I'm, as I think of this, I am just outraged over over the appearance of widespread congressional support. When I just heard Terry McAuliffe, the head of the Democratic National Committee, just suavely assure that yes, Congress would pass this, I'm ashamed. I'm deeply ashamed.
Linda, can I get you in there?
Well, I think that Mr. McAuliffe is right. The Congress is going to pass something which is going to give the president the authorization, perhaps not the language that he seeks in his initial draft, but some language that will be acceptable to the president. So I think it is going to happen. It's an interesting question how to justify what the United States is proposing to do. And I agree with the caller that this does represent a substantial and serious change. I think that a number of members of Congress, including people who are as close to the president as the House Majority Leader Dick Armey of Texas, has said this is not what the United States is about, preemptive strikes, going after somebody who might do something to us but hasn't yet done anything. So we're looking at, in the testimony that on the Hill, we're looking at a kind of a smorgasbord of potential legal justifications, legal arguments, ranging from the Article 51 of the UN Charter to one which was made yesterday by James Woolsey, who was a former CIA director, that the Iraqis were in violation of the ceasefire from 91, and therefore the United States needs nothing to go in and enforce that ceasefire.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Kathy, thanks for yours. And to Carver, Massachusetts, Michael's on the line. Michael.
Yes, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
My only question, I'm a little shocked by all this because Saddam Hussein is, he invaded a sovereign nation, okay? I was in the United States Marine Corps, and half of what you're seeing on TV is truth, and the president cannot, as a commander-in-chief, cannot release all this intelligence to make everybody understand everything. We have to have faith. I know this sounds a little strange, but we have to have faith in our government, in our leaders, and I believe we do. Colin Powell is a wonderful man. You see the ribbons on his chest? He didn't get those by talking about things and discuss. He's been through the horror of war. Nobody wants to go to war, but let me tell you what's even worse, our chemicals, because it's the worst warfare in the world. There's nothing. We have entropy. That's about all we have. You can do anything you want and kill as many people as you want. Now, this man has proven in the past what he's capable of doing, what he will do. When he is in violation of the weapons inspection, not attacking us, not doing anything. He's in violation of the weapons inspection.
Michael, you're a soldier, or you were a soldger?
Yes, sir. United States Marine Corps.
And the debate that's going on this week about whether or not the United States or the United Nations should be the agency that either disarms or overthrows, are you saying that the conversation ought not to be taking place?
Absolutely. No, you know something? That is why I was a soldier, so the conversation can take place. But when it gets to the point where the United Nations is running, where they're not even looking or listening to us anymore, and we have a valid point, sir. And God forbid something should happen. This man.
Hello, Michael. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
You're breaking up just a little bit. Can I get you to wrap up?
Yes, I agree with you. And the reason I was a soldier is for exactly why we're talking about it right now and what's been going on. But I've lost faith in the United Nations after what they come back with. It's pretty obvious what this man has done. And it's pretty obvious what the United Nations has not been able to do in the last 10 years, whatever it is.
Let's hear from Robin Wright on this, because there was that strong comment from President Bush that the UN is in danger of proving its irrelevancy. I may not have the quote right, but that's in effect what Bush is saying, is he not, Robin?
Yes, that's the spin that the administration
is using to try to squeeze members to go along with the United States on the use of force. Is to say it's not just the stake, not just the fate of Saddam Hussein, but it's really the fate of the United Nations as the world's most powerful international institution. On the issue of chemical weapons, you know, it's interesting to me. I covered the Iran-Iraq war and saw many of the victims of Iraq's use of chemical weapons on Iranians. And I've always been amazed that the United States, the United Nations, that someone has not charged Saddam Hussein with war crimes, whether it was during the 80s and in one of the bloodiest wars in the Middle East between Iran and Iraq, or in the aftermath of Operation Desert Storm, that this would have been a way also to try to get at Saddam in a more comfortable legal context with a lot of information and data that would have made a trial rather easy.
But to do that would have meant that the man would have had to stand trial, and part of the inability to pin down his country or his administration or him on the responsibility over the past 11 years of avoiding all the UN resolutions, I mean, the effect would be the same, wouldn't it, Robin?
It would, but it would, I think, have made many in the outside world feel much more comfortable with the way that the U.S. had chosen to do it, if it had, whether it was the first Bush administration or the Clinton administration. If there had been greater movement in trying to pursue the his violations of UN resolutions or his human rights abuses, I mean, the use of chemical weapons against 5,000 of his own people in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. that this would have, I think, made many in the world more comfortable.
Connection listeners, what we're talking about on this hour is the domestic drive to put together the U.S. position against Iraq, coupled with the international activity that's taking place at the United Nations, the words in both cities that one should come first or one should take primacy over the other. How do you see it playing out? Is it hard to follow how exactly you think it's going to go? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the week that was, the push to draft a UN Security Council resolution or resolutions condemning Iraq, the same thing going on with the Bush resolution in Washington. A little bit earlier in the program, I was talking with one of my guests, Robin Wright, about the meeting that's coming up later today with Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov visiting the White House. A piece of wire copy quotes him from the Itar-Tass news agency in Russia, saying that Russia's position would depend on the information the Bush administration provides about Baghdad's possession of weapons of mass destruction, plays directly to exactly what our caller Michael was talking about when he said, you know, you can't expect the administration to be giving out every bit of private information that it has, that you simply at some point have to trust the elected leaders. With me on the program, as I said, Robin Wright from the LA Times, Linda Wertheimer, NPR's senior national correspondent. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to Ryan, who's been hanging on the line. He's in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I've got a couple of points. It seems to me the mystery about timing and sequences of these votes is really silly. This is an obvious attempt to railroad both Congress and the UN into signing off on a U.S. attack. And as one of your callers
said,
the
faster it's done, the less consideration of it there is?
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a sort of human wave attack on Congress and the UN. Look, there's a nightmare scenario for the backers of this war, which is that they won't get their war. They won't get the justification for the war.
Justification where? In Congress?
In the administration and especially in the Defense Department. You remember back in 91 there was a nightmare scenario, which was that Saddam would withdraw from Kuwait, before the U.S. had a chance to attack. It was actually described that way by administration officials. Now the nightmare scenario is that he will actually, for whatever reason, churlishly, I'm sure, permit inspections and engage in disarmament. So let's talk about national interest.
Let me stop you there for a minute if I can, Ryan, because the thing about timing I think is important, despite the fact that you say that it's silly. Robin, you outlined one scenario in a piece that you wrote saying that we're looking at 2 weeks to get the resolutions put together, 4 weeks to get the inspectors back on the job, 6 months to have all the weapons destroyed, or else? Is the or else a big part of that?
I think so. I think everyone in the United States government believes, Democrat or Republican, believes that Saddam Hussein is going to balk at some juncture. His weapons of mass destruction are critical to his existence, his ambition, his strategy at home and abroad. They're the one thing that keep him in power, that element of fear. And I think the administration believes that there will be some confrontation. Now, in terms of timing, this is where the game has begun. The Saddam Hussein scored a point, basically, on Monday by allowing the weapons inspectors to return, at least pledging that he would. This took the administration by surprise. Everyone believed that at some juncture he would be sufficiently squeezed that he would have to at the 11th hour, but he pulled the rug out from underneath the United States and its efforts to get a resolution at the UN by saying, okay, we'll allow them to come back now.
Clearly, saying it is one thing, doing it is another, though, right?
That's right, and that's all he's promised. He didn't say, look, I will, hand over, surrender everything I've got. All he said is that he will allow the weapons inspectors to return. And already the language used by his foreign minister yesterday at the United Nations indicated that Baghdad intends to bring up some of the old issues, such as sovereignty, which then would keep some of the presidential palaces and the executive branch offices off limits to the weapons inspectors. So, as I said, the games have begun. Saddam scored a point at this point preemptively.
Has Ryan put his finger on something when he says that, it's all just an attempt to bully the U.S. position past before anybody really has an opportunity to sit and think about it?
Well, go ahead, Linda.
That might be more true of the Congress than it is of the United Nations, which has, after all, passed resolutions on Iran. I mean, Robin knows the numbers better than I do, but the president reeled them off several times in 96, several times in 98. The Congress is anxious for reasons of its own to move ahead with dispatch. You count the House, you look at it, it appears that the president has the votes for some form of authorization. So therefore, I think the thinking on the part of the Democrats is get it done. Get it off the table as an issue. Don't let this become part of the campaign. Besides which, of course, there is, I think, very strong sympathy for the president's position. And there is that lingering, little political aftertaste of 91, those people who voted against the president, sort of thinking in Vietnam terms that this is no longer a country, that this is not a country that goes to war, found that there was some bitterness afterwards that they had done so. I think many of them regretted that vote when they opposed the first President Bush's request for authorization. So I think that the Congress has some politics going here.
All the foregoing makes good sense to me, practically everything everyone said. But it seems to me it's peripheral. There's a more important subject here, which is the issue of national interests. Now, many, many critics, including this morning on All Things Considered, John Mearsheimer, have pointed out that the war on al-Qaeda will be disrupted, most likely, by the political reaction, the metastasizing terror that is likely to occur if the U.S. Attacks or hornswoggles the U.N. into signing off on an attack against Iraq. There's a taboo subject. This has nothing to do with U.S. interests. But truthfully, it has a lot to do with Israeli interests and with the interests of the, if it's fair to call them, the Israeli war lobby in the Defense Department, Richard Perle, Rumsfeld, and so on. Their aim is to lock in, to join at the hip with crazy glue, American policy and Israeli policy. It's the taboo subject. It's never discussed on shows like this. Honestly, you guys really should focus on this issue in depth, and I believe repeatedly on this program.
You think that it's a taboo subject, Ryan, even though it doesn't appear in the president's resolution? You're saying it's taboo for the president as well?
We all know what's going on. I mean, we all know there are foreign policy lobbies. And the Israeli lobby is not the only one. There's a Cuban lobby in Miami. Various countries have had effective lobbies.
Let's let Linda and Robin in on this. They know the way this place works a whole lot better than I do.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of concern about how this would affect Israel, and it was asked in all the hearings that I went to. The question was asked, what would happen if we were to attack, the United States were to attack Iraq? Would Iraq immediately attack Israel? And if that happened, then what would happen next? Would Israel respond? Would the United States have to sort of move fronts and defend Israel? There's a great deal of concern about what happens to Israel. But some of those members of Congress who are traditionally the greatest friends of Israel in the House and the Senate are among the strongest supporters of the president's efforts in Iraq. So somebody besides Richard Perl sees this as something that will be ultimately good for Israel.
Robin?
I agree with Linda. I think in the outside world, they don't see it quite as we do. Israel is, Harry Truman made a commitment that the United States would stand by Israel, and it has ever since. And that's a commitment the United States made that there are others in the outside world don't share. But I do think it's true that if Iraq, calculating that it could change the axis of loyalty or of the conflict, does strike Israel, you will probably see Israel strike back as the government has already said it will. And then many of the Arabs who are worried about Saddam Hussein are going to feel that they may have to side with Saddam because the access, the focus, the alliances in the war have changed, and that's a real danger.
Well, there's good historical evidence here as well, though, with the Israeli jets taking out the nuclear reactor that was in Iraq. And then, I mean, I was in Jordan in 91 when the Scud missiles were going right over top of us on their way from launch sites in Iraq to Tel Aviv and places in Israel. It's not like necessarily the threat against Israel is something that is imagined. Go ahead,
Dick.
Linda.
When this question was asked of Donald Rumsfeld, he said that there is no question that neighbors like Israel would be vulnerable, but he said not for very long in the event of an attack. I mean, I think the United States is planning, assuming a very quick turnaround in that country. And then he went on to say that it would be, and he emphasized this, it would be in Israel's overwhelming interest not to get involved, not to respond.
That's very true, and I think that the U.S. military operation, one of the earliest ones, will be taking out any missile positions in southwestern Iraq, which is really the place they need to be in order to strike Israel, because the range is so long. That's the place they'd go, and that's the place we're likely to strike first.
I want to go back to a little bit of the politics here. This is something that you two work with on a daily basis, and that was the idea that from the Democratic point of view, perhaps it would be a good thing to move this off the table as quickly as possible and deal with other issues leading into the election. Is there a chance, Linda, that the rush put on by the Bush administration could in effect backfire, that next week if Congress says, yep, here's your resolution, go and deal with it, and we're going to start talking about the trouble with the economy and other issues that don't reflect so well on the Republicans, that all the hurry could in fact end up hurting Bush?
I must say that it's very hard to imagine how anything preempts an actual mobilization and the possibility of an attack. That is just so incredibly important to everybody that I would not be sure that the subject could be changed. But there's It is very interesting to see, as we saw this morning, that the front page of the daily papers that I read, the New York Times and the Washington Post, are full of stories about Iraq, and the business page had, you know, on the right-hand column head in the New York Times business section was stocks plunge. On another day, that kind of dunk might have been on the front page. So we're looking, you know, we're watching how this works out. If people begin sincerely to feel that their own personal economies are in danger, then there might be some response. But, you know, we are just talking about a whole different world here, as members of Congress and members of the administration keep saying. The United States was attacked. That changes the point of view for a lot of people. A surprising number of Americans who normally you would imagine would be very resistant to the idea of attacking Iraq are not as resistant as I would have thought they would be. There's a strong sentiment in this country that the United States is vulnerable and something has to be done about that.
Robin, do you hear that reflected in conversations at the UN, a recognition and acknowledgement from the international people there of the changed world that Linda's describing?
Sure. There is a great deal of concern about the threat that Saddam Hussein poses, and I think everyone particularly feels it even more so after 9/11. But at the same time, there is a general sense of relief at the United Nations that Iraq has agreed to allow the weapons inspectors back. Many people believe that diplomacy should be given a chance, and they don't agree with this momentum to use force. Maybe pass a resolution saying, Saddam Hussein, you have to comply this time, no fudging. But they're very nervous, I think, about adding this issue of force, at least at this stage.
I want to thank both of you for your insight this hour. Robin Wright, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for the LA Times. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Linda Wertheimer, NPR Senior National Correspondent. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you, Dick.
Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. We had help today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, and Carl Volker. Our interns are Meredith Levinson and Clint Cavanaugh. Graham Smith is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is